BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the broadcaster Annie Nightingale. Always forward-facing, she's remained at the sharp end of popular culture for over half a century, searching for new music, spearheading new movements and supporting emerging artists, from David Bowie and Ian Dury to Acid House, Breakbeat and beyond. As well as breaking artists, she's known for breaking boundaries. She was a music journalist when the BBC created Radio 1, their all-male response to the hugely popular pirate radio stations of the 60s. She called them out on their sexism in print, and they finally gave her a show, becoming Radio 1's first female DJ in 1970. 50 years later, she remains their longest-serving presenter and has won a host of accolades, including a CBE in this year's New Year's Honours list, which she describes as the coolest big-up ever. She says, "I didn't get on the radio to be famous. I only wanted it as a medium to get the music out there. It's like calling someone up on the phone and playing the record for them to say, 'Hey, I just heard this. What do you think?'" Annie Nightingale, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you spent 50 years at Radio 1. Has the role of a DJ changed over that time?
It has and yet it hasn't. I think you would agree that we are there because of our love, our passion and enthusiasm about music. And so In that sense, it hasn't changed. The ways of doing it and the technology have obviously changed immensely, and the social attitude. But basically, I think it's a very simple thing.
And of course, your hunger for new music, that's remained the same throughout your life. And that's not the case for everyone, is it? What are you looking for when you're listening to new music?
Well, I have to quote John Peel, because he put it best, which is, you want to hear something you've never heard before. And I couldn't put it better than that. Something that surprised you. And the more music we have, I think it's actually more difficult. And you get people saying, "Oh, it's all been done before," or "That was a copy of something else." And people get very jaded. They lose that excitement of finding the freshness in new music, which somehow I seem to have been able to hang on to.
And is that what it's about? It's a feeling, that excitement?
A thrill. It's absolutely so exciting. I actually get a physical sensation. I get shivers up and down my legs when I hear something that becomes very successful. And that is why this thing about wanting to play it to somebody else and say, "Is it just me? Do you like this as well?"
I think we're going to dive into the music then, Annie. I mean, how on earth have you chosen your discs today?
Oh, very, very different means. So the first one, because I think young people know music. They cut through all the, the publicity and the promotion and stuff. So my first disc is by Billie Eilish, who was introduced to me by a 13-year-old girl. And I think she and her brother Phineas, once in a lifetime talent.
Come here.
Say it, spit it out. What is it exactly you're paying? Is the amount cleaning you out? Am I satisfactory? Today I'm thinking about the things that are deadly. The way I'm drinking you down, like I wanna drown, like I wanna end me. Step on the glass, staple your tongue. Bury a friend, try to wake up. Cannibal class, killing the sun. Bury a friend. I want to end me.
Billie Eilish and Bury a Friend. So, Annie Nightingale, you've spent your life in radio. What part did it play in family life when you were little?
Absolutely huge. I grew up in World War II and post-World War II. Mm-hmm. And all I had was the radio and all I had was the BBC. And so it was children's hour and it was music. And it had such an effect on me. The first word I tried to say was music, but I said music because I didn't know how to say it. And violins, I'm still scared of because they affect me so much.
So you were very sensitive to music then?
Very sensitive. You've got exactly the right word, Lauren. I was sensitive to music overly much. And there are tunes I can't listen to now because I get too emotional about them. I have been DJing the festival in the Isle of Wight in the middle of a massive storm of people dancing in the rain. And I was being so emotional about that and the music that I'd be in tears over it just because we were sharing that. I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, that's just how I've always been.
You were the only child of Basil and Celia, and you've said you couldn't have had a more suburban, semi-detached experience in post-war Twickenham. What kind of neighbourhood was that to grow up in?
Well, it's now quite posh, but it didn't seem to me then. But I was an only child, but not only that, my father was one of four, and none of the other three had any children. So it was a bit like having five parents. And it was like the Mad Hatter's tea party every time you went to their house. Would you like some more tea? Have you got enough cake? Are you warm enough? I mean, they were wonderful. They were kind of eccentric. And I'm sure those people have an influence on you that you don't realise for a long, long time.
Yeah, what about your dad? Because he inherited his father's wallpaper business, but it wasn't something that he enjoyed.
No, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And my father should never have been made to do it. He was not happy. My mother was not happy with him. They were unhappily married. You know, that's how the way it was.
And prior to her marriage, your mother had trained as a chiropodist with Dr. Scholl, I believe. She'd had the opportunity to go and work with him, I think, in the States.
Right. He wanted to take her to America, is what she used to tell me. And her mother said, no, you can't go. Now, I used to say, well, why didn't you just go? Because I felt that, you know, she'd had missed opportunities. They had to bring me up a small child during World War II. And at the end of that, my mother had lost her confidence in becoming a working woman again. And that, I feel very strongly, I think that's influenced my life, of wanting to encourage women to feel confident and to carry on working and have that fulfilment.
Annie, it's time to hear your second disc today. What have you chosen and why?
Why, this goes back a long time. So this is a song from a musical called Gypsy, which I think appeared on Broadway 1959, 1960. And I had a friend who went to New York and brought the album back to me and I played it. I mean, I knew every single song on it. And the main singer in it was Ethel Merman, very, very strong voice. And there's a song on there which really got to me. And what it did for me was it sparked a feeling of, yes, you could go out and do things you want to in the world.
Some people sit on their butts, got the dream, yeah, but not the guts. That's living for some people, for some humdrum people, I suppose.
Ethel Merman singing Some People from the musical Gypsy, composed by Julie Stein with lyrics by Stephen Sondheim and performed by the original Broadway cast. So Annie Nightingale, I want to ask about your time at school. Now, your parents weren't Catholics, but you attended a Catholic school. How did you get on there?
Well, I was sent to a convent when I was five. And I think they sent me there because they thought it turned out nicely spoken young girls. I went crazy with it. There were statues everywhere of Jesus and pictures of Jesus. We didn't have pop stars then. So, you know, Jesus was the pop star, Virgin Mary's pop star. We collected pictures of them. We collected rosaries. We'd have them blessed by the local priest. They were our pop stars. And I think my parents were somewhat alarmed. So I was on my way to becoming a nun by the time I was 7, 8 or 9. So that and the fact that I had become so obsessed with telling the truth. We had this jingle, it's better to die than tell a lie. And I'd had to tell some little white lie and I thought that was it, it was all over for me. And I think my parents realised I was taking it all terribly seriously. So then I took an entrance exam to a school called Lady Eleanor Hollis, which is very posh and very academic. And I won a scholarship there, which was probably just as well because my parents would never been able to afford the fees.
So you were off to public school. Your reputation there apparently was flighty. What did that mean in practice?
Well, yeah, I was very keen on movies. I would go miles to see movies on my own. I was very keen on music. And very close to me was a place called Eel Pie Island. Now, this was notorious. It was very influential. It's on a little island in the Thames. And I wasn't actually allowed to go, but the influence is there. And people like the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, everybody went and played there. And that and a coffee bar in Richmond called L'Auberge, that's where my life changed. I became this beatnik. I saw real teenage rebellion. And that is why they did not consider me Oxford material at school and vaguely disapproved of me.
It was interesting when you were introducing the track by Ethel Merman, you described the feeling of music making you feel brave. Did you feel like that as a teenager when you were taking in all of these incredible artists who were playing in a club, you know, in touching distance of where you were growing up?
Well, yes. I mean, there were massive influences early on. BBC Radio, that's all there was. Then we discovered Radio Luxembourg, and that changed everything for us. R&B, Fats Domino and Little Richard. And I was listening to that on my own. And so were a whole generation all over the UK, including Four Guys in Liverpool. And that music was not being played on the BBC. It was our secret world, and it was incredibly exciting.
Annie, it's time for your third disc today. What are we going to hear next?
Well, obviously, most people say, oh, you're going to do Desert Island Disc, which Beatles track are you going to have? It's impossible. So I've gone for a John Lennon track, which he made after the Beatles. I mean, I feel I'm almost going to apologise, you know, as if it matters. But they changed my life, the Beatles, and I'm in debt to them. And so I'm going to say sorry, Paul and Ringo and George, to choosing a John song. Every time you hear the opening moment of it, it lifts you up. I like upbeat, positive music. And so that's why this is Instant Karma.
Karma's gonna get you, gonna knock you right on the head. You better get yourself together, pretty soon you're gonna be dead.
John Lennon and Instant Karma. So, Annie, you'd set your heart on becoming a journalist. You took a course in central London, though you spent most of your time hanging out in Soho. What was it like at the time?
Well, this was realising my bohemian life. And, I mean, the people who really lived it properly, I hadn't got the nerve to go that far. I was still the suburban ex-schoolgirl at heart. I didn't know much about life. And doing this journalism course, right beside Broadcasting House. I never imagined in a million years that I would end up working at the BBC. The BBC was a kind of remote, rather foreboding building. And the music led me to Soho. And I used to hang out at a coffee bar that had a wonderful jukebox. And the people there were hardcore Soho people, sex workers and so on. And my innocence kind of, I think, protected me. You know, they were kind of respectful for my innocence, but it helped me grow up.
While you were working as a trainee journalist, you met your first husband. He was married at the time, but the two of you set up home in Brighton and then subsequently you got married and you got a job. You were the only woman working on the Evening Argus, where you began reviewing records. So this would be the early 60s and your column was called Spin With Me.
Yes,
tell me about this.
I don't think I chose that. Well, I was a general reporter and I'd done everything. And they'd said they wouldn't have me because I hadn't got the right background. But it's just as well they gave me an opportunity because it was the most wonderful training you could have. You didn't think at the time, covering things like Paris council meeting or council meetings, covering court reporting. But I was learning so much. To make something out of one paragraph is much more difficult. The big stories about themselves. But I still didn't know what was coming. I was thinking, I'm 19 and my life is ebbing away. So, you know, I'm quite an impatient person and you don't know what might be around the corner. I tried to hang on to that. But I think, you know, you have to believe in yourself and try and follow your dreams.
Time for your next disc, Annie. Tell us about this one. What are we going to hear next?
Well, this represents a big, important time in my life and in music, because I was a journalist and had a record column. I had access to be able to interview people. All the bands toured and they all came to Brighton. So I had a very good opportunity to go and interview them and meet them. And that is how I met the Beatles. And I was able to interview Dusty Springfield in Brighton, where I lived. And I went backstage after the show and Dusty said, "Oh, this is Vicky Wickham." And I went, "Oh, you're the very person I want to meet," because I knew that Vicky Wickham was the editor of Ready, Steady, Go, the first really brilliant pop TV show that brought Motown. It brought black music to us, which we'd never heard before. And why it changed me was I was part managing a band, and I said to Vicky, "Oh, I'd love to get our band on Ready, Steady, Go." So she said, "Well, bring the record to me in London." So I did, and they went, "Well, okay, we'll think about that. But actually, we're looking for a presenter for a new show, a sister show to Ready, Steady, Go. Would you be interested?" Well, imagine. Yes. So suddenly I was involved in that world and was produced by the same people that made Ready, Steady, Go. And then I used to go every week to this live show. And you'd be in the studio, in the audience, and Stevie Wonder would be a metre away from you, or the Supremes. It was unbelievable. Anyway, every Friday night after Ready, Steady, Go, we would go to Soho and have dinner. And after that, we went to the Ad Lib Club. And this is where you would hear this Motown music being played. But this is one which, again, the words got to me. And it was by the Marvelettes, and it's called Too Many Fish in the Sea.
And Too Many Fish in the Sea. Annie Nightingale, in your autobiography, you describe hanging out at the Beatles' Apple Studios, and there was quite a lot of hospitality on offer. How hedonistic was it down there?
Well, they had this office, a white building, Georgian building in Savile Row, and Crazy's Company. All the carpets were apple green, and it was very smart and elegant. And they began to sign other artists, and I thought, they've already helped me. How could I give something back to them? And so I would interview all the bands that they'd signed. And so I started to spend more time there, and I was accepted. But I also knew that they had a kind of code, a sort of one strike and you're out. You let them down, you break that trust, and that's it. It's over. And I thought that was perfectly fair. I knew about John and Yoko before it was announced, and had a newspaper column, and this was hugely big news at the time. And I thought, well, I'm not going to say anything. I won't break their trust. But if that story breaks, then they'll think, it's your fault. And it wasn't. So when they did go public, it was a great relief, because sometimes, it's not good to be in the right place at the right time. And I wasn't hanging out there the whole time, but it was an extraordinary atmosphere. Laura McCall would come in there, and Jimmy Webb, the songwriter, people just appeared. And I took my son to the Apple Christmas party, and John Lennon was Father Christmas and Yoko was Mother Christmas. they did extraordinary things, and I felt very, very privileged to be allowed in.
It's time to take a break for some music, Annie. Disc number 5, what is it and why have you chosen it?
This was 1969, so it took me years before I could persuade Radio 1 to let me have a go. So I was still writing my music column. And then this record came along, and it was at the time of the first moon shots, and so we were all obsessed with space. And this tune came along called Space Oddity by David Bowie. And I had never heard anything like that before. And by this time, the Beatles, the cracks were beginning to show. One would begin to be aware that they wanted to go their different ways and that they were not going to last that much longer. And everyone was saying, "Oh, so what group is going to follow the Beatles?" And I thought, it's not going to be necessarily another band. It's this guy David Bowie. I was absolutely convinced.
This is ground.
David Bowie and Space Oddity.
It still gets to me.
I mean, just fantastic. Annie Nightingale, when they set up Radio 1 in 1967, as you say, it's this all-male lineup. You went and knocked on their door, but you were rebuffed. What did they say to you?
Oh, yes. I mean, rebuffed is the word, Lauren. That is the word. They said, no, absolutely not. And I went, well, why? Because I hadn't actually really experienced sexism until then. I'd never experienced this wall of, no, you can't. And so I said, why? And then they came out with this wonderful line. They said, our disc jockeys are husband substitutes, which I thought was
wow.
extraordinary thing to say. And I thought that that set up a lot of assumptions that all the women pop fans were housewives at home doing the ironing, and they would sort of say to me, why would a woman want to be a DJ? But they were bewildered.
In 1969, a new controller at Radio 1, Douglas Muggeridge, arrived and asked Derek Taylor, the Beatles publicist, if he could recommend a female DJ, and he said you. What do you remember about your first broadcast?
It was a disaster. It was a complete disaster. I still didn't know what was going on technically. So there was this, I mean, it's obviously vinyl in those days, so this record was going round and round, and I thought, well, it's not doing anything, so I'll press the stop button. And it didn't stop. It ground slowly to a halt. So, you know, I brought the network to a halt on my very first show, and I thought, well, that's it. You know, you had your chance. You've been pestering them all this time, and now you've blown it. And they were very forgiving and let me carry on.
You were the only woman and you would remain so for the next 12 years until 1982 when Janice Long arrived. What was the atmosphere like at the place at the time you joined?
It was all boys. They were very competitive with each other. So I was kind of extraneous, really. I don't know what they thought of me, really, but it was kind of locker room humour. I didn't feel very involved with them. Most of them. Johnny Walker was always very kind to me.
I know that you said you did endure chauvinistic attitudes from engineers in the studio. From the studio next door, they would criticise the music while you were playing it out, yes. So you could hear it in your headphones.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been difficult to handle.
Very daunting. Yeah, and I felt that the technical guys were waiting for me to fail. There was very much, I felt like the woman driver. I think, actually, the BBC also wanted it to fail. I think they thought, OK, we've got to do this pop radio and we'll give it a year. And I think they were, you know, would be quite happy if it had not worked out. So, you know, there was a huge pressure on all of the people who worked in Radio 1 to make it happen. So they made their DJs super famous, you know, 20 million listeners. There was no commercial radio, so they had no competitors.
You've been so encouraging and supportive to me and many other women who've gone on to follow in your footsteps, Annie. I wonder who supported you during that period, because that must have been difficult at times.
Well, I suppose your friends, your family. I have some very good producers, and you can pour out your worries and your troubles to them and say, oh, yeah, I'm so worried, I made a mistake. You know, you play the record at the wrong speed. You played 33 instead of 45. Or you played the wrong album version, which got the swearing on it. It was all live. So there were a lot of mistakes that could be made, and I made a lot of mistakes. But then I began to feel, as the 70s happened, there were these programmes in the evening called Sounds of the 70s with John Peel and others. And I didn't see myself as being the daytime DJ. I wanted to be there to play the music that I cared about, not to become a celebrity. And I could feel that these daytime guys were being groomed to be big showbiz stars because Radio 1 needed them to be. I said to the boss, I said, can I be on in the evening? And it was the best question, the best decision I ever made.
It's time to go to the music, Annie. Disc number 6.
Well, I've had this long career. I've witnessed changes in music, which have been incredibly exciting. And one of the biggest step changes ever was rap, and how that took over America and the world and has brought about people who've become so important, like Beyoncé.
Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom, cut me loose, yeah, freedom.
Beyoncé and Freedom featuring Kendrick Lamar. Annie Nightingale, your first marriage had ended in 1968 and you had two young children, Alex and Lucy, to look after. How did you manage, you know, balance this as well?
I bring them with me whenever possible. When I was doing a Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening show, they would come to Broadcasting House. They couldn't do it now. And I'd go, OK, run around, have fun, don't do anything terrible. And then we'll drive back and then we'd do rehearsing times tables on the way home. And I had to have help. We had au pairs and people probably the same age as me. And so I'd go, oh, that was this great gig. Must take this as a gig. And then we had to find somebody else to be the babysitter for them because I wanted them to have a good time as well.
Tell me about your approach as a journalist, balancing your own personal feelings and morals with covering stories. You mentioned earlier not spilling the beans about John and Yoko being a couple. How do you strike that balance when it comes, for example, to getting a great interview but not invading someone's privacy?
Well, I'm chicken. I'm glad you asked me that. I realised in my very, very early days, going out on a breaking story with a microphone, trying to get a quote from somebody, it's a very tough job. And it got to the point where I was being pressured by Fleet Street to write things about people that I wasn't comfortable with. And I went, I can't do it. I can't. So that's why my involvement with the BBC, I'm forever grateful for, because the BBC was not saying, right, you've got to go and shop somebody and tell us the inside story of their marriage breaking up. I knew I couldn't do that. So it saved me. It saved my, you know, it just did, because I was not good at that. I didn't want to be good at it either.
You're a very private person too as well, Annie. Why is that important to you?
I don't know, really. You don't want to hurt other people, I guess. You might talk about somebody else and they go, how could you say that's about me? And you think, well, I didn't mean it in a bad way. Perhaps because I appreciated all that. When it came to me to be in the public eye, if you like, I was more conscious of, you know, the damage that you can do.
I wonder if it's an important discipline as well to hold something back because, you know, as a broadcaster, you've got to go on no matter what's happening in your personal life. It's your job to show up and do your job for your listener or your viewer.
Absolutely. I could not have put that better. And actually, if you're feeling ill, it's a great thing to be on air because all your symptoms, you've got flu or something, will go away because the adrenaline takes it away while you're on air. I think the concentration level is so important that you can actually blot out anything else in your life. And that is a kind of escapism. And I've always found that if I was going through a bad time in my personal life, then once I was on air, it's a magic that takes over and you're with your listener.
Annie, we've got to take a break for some music. This is your penultimate disc.
So this is a little different. It was actually introduced to me, I think, by Robert Fripp, who's a dear friend. And I think he introduced me to Eric Satie. And there's this series of pieces called Etoiles Gymnopédies. And when I couldn't become a dancer, which I would have loved to have done, but didn't have the physique for it, and I could waft around to this. And then when my last relative died, my Uncle Bill, and I organised his funeral, and this was my most daring thing to have played at his funeral. And people came up to me after and said, oh, very good, really liked the music. And it's a beautiful piece.
Satie's Gymnopédie No. 1, performed by the Slovak State Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Peter Briner. Annie Nightingale, every radio station refreshes its lineup from time to time, but you're still at Radio 1, the longest serving DJ there. What's your secret, I wonder?
I don't know. I'm deeply grateful for the continuing opportunities to do what I love doing. Young music is for young people. And as they grow up and they grow older, they have other things come into their lives. But for me, it carried on. What's going to come next? And I feel if I can help anybody get a foothold on the ladder of recognition, because there's so much music now, you can make music at home in your bedroom and you can put it on all these different digital platforms. But who is going to take notice of it? And so I know what it means to get your tune played on national radio. So Vicky Wickham, who I mentioned earlier, I said to her, I owe you so much. She said, pass it on. And I think that's true. And if I've been able to do that, then great.
Just one more disc before you go. What's it going to be?
So the story about this is it's an old song given a punk cover by Sid Vicious. So it was a song called My Way. I was never very keen on it. I could see that it had a very strong lyric. Sid Vicious came along and deconstructed it completely, and I loved it. Why it's resonated more recently is this, that friends of mine are Primal Scream, and the wife of their guitarist, Andrew Innes, her name is Alison, and her birthday and mine are the same day, April 1st, and we tend to hang out together and do something. So a few years ago, Primal Scream were playing at the London Palladium on April 1st, and we sat in the Royal Box. And at the end of their set, the going out music, when everyone leaves the theatre, was Sid Vicious' version of My Way, and I thought it fitted so beautifully.
Part of Sid Vicious's My Way, and we couldn't play the whole thing because in the true spirit of punk, not all the lyrics are playable on daytime Radio 4. Right. Annie Nightingale, it's time to send you off to the island. We'll give you the books, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare and a book of your choice. What would you like to take with you?
Well, I said, you know, I'm a big Shakespeare fan, so I'll enjoy Shakespeare. I think the book I would take would be Catch 22.
Joseph Haller.
It made me laugh.
What about a luxury item for pleasure or sensory stimulation?
I think a saxophone.
Ah, can you play?
No, but I could learn. And it would catch the sunlight, so it might act like an SOS. And I love the sound of it.
And finally, the most difficult question of all for you, Annie. If you had to save just one of these 8 discs from being destroyed by a tropical storm, which would you go for?
I think because of what was to become the longevity of his career and all the things he did and the changes that he made, the thrill that I got and I still get from first hearing A Space Odyssey, it would be that. I never get tired of hearing it.
And it's kind of about a castaway too, so it's perfect. Annie Nightingale, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you, Lauren, very, very much.
I'm sure that Annie will master the sax by the time she's rescued by a passing ship. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. She was the only female presenter of the Old Grey Whistle Test for a number of years, and her predecessor, Bob Harris, also features in the Desert Island Discs back catalogue, including a host of musicians that Annie knew or championed, including Paul McCartney and Ian Dury. They're all available to listen to via our website or on BBC Sounds. Next time, my guest will be the writer, actor, and producer, Sharon Horgan. I do hope you'll join us.